If you got one of the folders toward the back, there's about 8 sheets of an outline for this session. It is an outline. It's not any way copious notes. I think I will be able to cover all the things in that outline, and probably you'll see me adding a few things. I may jockey with the order a little bit, but that helps me keep on balance and maybe gives you a little guidepost, and depending upon your note-taking capacity, you can augment that, because I didn't really leave you lots of room for that. I begin with this slide. Our topic is Satan's attack, and primarily the first week will be on society, the second week will be on the church. But as I think you understand, those two overlap and intermingle. So some of the things we talk about the first week will also be applicable to the church, and some of the things we talk about the second week will also be applicable to society. Whatever affects society eventually affects the church. It may take it a decade or a decade and a half to do so. Divorce, remarriage, classic example. Homosexuality, classic example. We've not been hit with it in the church. Maybe with both barrels, we're just kind of playing footsie with it in terms of having to deal with it. But in the next decade, it will probably be much more than having to play footsie with it. Everything you do, everything I do, is based on the choices we make. It's not our parents. It's not our past relationships. It's not our job, nor the economy, the weather, an argument, or your age that is to blame. You and only you are responsible for every decision and choice that you make, period. And I begin with that because we're going to be talking about Satan's attack on society and the church. Having said that, and he has much fault to bear, what we do in society and what we do in the church is our responsibility, and it is our blame if we don't do it. It is to our glory and his glory if we do it appropriately. But we are at war. I don't consider myself an alarmist. I don't really consider myself an extremist, although I don't imagine any alarmist and extremist considers themselves an alarmist or an extremist. But I do think it is important for us to begin with the concept that we are at war, and Satan is attacking our society, and he is attacking the church. That is nothing new. It's just maybe a little new to us because we're living in this age. We haven't lived in other ages. I want to begin in the book of Job. You're familiar with the book of Job, so I don't have to go back and recapitulate it. In the first chapter, Satan goes to the Lord, asks permission, if you will, or the boundaries from which he can attack Job. And Job takes a terrible hit. The loss of his property, the loss of his wealth, the loss of his children, to some extent the loss of his health. But I find it very interesting when we get to chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, again, very familiar verses to you. It says, "Then said his wife unto him, Do you still retain your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaks. What, shall I receive good at the hand of God, and shall I not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips." Question. God had taken all of Job's children. Satan had taken, with God's permission, Job's children. Have you ever wondered why Satan didn't take Job's wife? I don't really mean that to be overly humorous. When I read verse 9 and 10, I would think she might have been a sacrificial lamb. Why didn't? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us, but that doesn't keep me from having an opinion that maybe can make a point. Before I make that point, however, notice in verse 9, she doesn't say, "Job, why don't you just die?" She says, "Why don't you curse God and die?" Why the twofold admonition? If she had been looking out for Job's good, I would say, okay, I can understand Job, just die. You won't hurt. You won't have all this grief. If he was a righteous man, as we're told in chapter 1, what would have happened to Job if he had simply died? I could probably make a good case he would have gone to Abraham's bosom or paradise. That's not a bad position. But she doesn't say, Job, why don't you just die? She says, why don't you curse God and die? Well, had he done that, it would be the cursing of God or the abandonment of God, I think, that would have probably sealed his destiny in a very precarious way. Had Job just died, I think you can make a case paradise would have been his destiny. But had he cursed God and died, I think torment would have been his destiny. So why do you think Satan didn't take Mrs. Job? Well, I don't want to be overly harsh to her, and this is no indictment of women over men, it's just human nature. I wonder if Satan didn't leave her there as a tool to attack Job. I don't know what his relationship to his wife was, but it must have been somewhat close. Certainly intimacy, they had 10 children. And yet she comes to him, the one that I want to think she loved, and says, curse God and die. I wonder if Satan didn't spare this woman to be a further attack on Job. Sometimes our attacks from Satan come from those who are closest to us. Sometimes they come to us even from our loved ones, from our families. There is nothing really that is off limits, it would seem to me. I don't really subscribe to this because I don't think I can, it's quite biblical, I just found it humorous. One commentator thinking about why Job's wife was spared. You remember back in the 42nd chapter of Job, he got back twofold. And one wag said, well, God didn't want Job to have two like this woman. I don't really think that's true because it doesn't appear that his family came back twofold. It was more his possessions that came back twofold. In Ephesians chapter 6, particularly in verse 11, it talks about the wiles of Satan. Comes from the Greek word, methodia, which is methods. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 14, it's referred to as lying in wait, same Greek word. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11, it's the concept of devices, which is an allusion to this same thing. Satan's schemes, his wiles, his lying in wait. Because he approaches us covertly, he approaches us in darkness. I believe Satan uses cunning rather than power. He can come from those closest to us, i.e. Job's wife. He seeks to delude and deceive rather than to vanquish by mere force, because I don't think he's strong enough to vanquish simply by force. He lays before us temptations that do not immediately repel us. If they immediately repelled us, they wouldn't be successful temptations. He invites us to pleasures that seem harmless. We are at war. During these 2 weeks, we're going to be discussing Satan's attack on society and the church. And there is a lot of what I would call red meat that we could delve into. And we will have to delve into some of that. Red meat, I'm talking about issues that really generate our ire or our disdain. Adultery, divorce, homosexuality, premarital sex, alcoholism, on down the list. And there's no end to that. Someone sent me an email a couple of weeks ago and says, you will not have any trouble coming up with material. Well, that is true. But what I've decided to do, at least in the initial day or two, is to try to take a step back from all of that. Yes, We do have attacks on our society and on our church in areas of sexuality, marriage, family, homosexuality, integrity, abortion, prejudice, education. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And we could spend a day on each one of those, how Satan is attacking us in our marriage, in our homes, in our educational system, in integrity and in ethics. And again, as I said, we will do that to some extent. But I'd like to back up and say and think, what is the underlying strategy of Satan? What is the underlying strategy of Satan? Millard Fillmore once said, "May God save our country, because it's obvious people will not." And I think that's true. Time magazine, several decades ago actually, had an article that proposed this question: what's wrong with the world? G.K. Chesterton wrote a letter to the editor of the Time magazine, which may have been the shortest letter to the editor they ever received, and it said the following: "Dear sirs, I am yours truly, G.K. Chesterton." And what he was saying was, what's wrong with the world? We are wrong with the world. Man is wrong with the world. We are responsible. Maybe not you and I for each of the dilemmas of the world, but mankind is responsible for the world. In Ephesians chapter 6, and I'm not going to spend time going through the various pieces of armor, because that would be a study in and of itself. But it's interesting that Paul concludes that letter to the Ephesians with the concept of what was most maybe paramount on his mind for them. And the motif of Ephesians 6, putting on the armor to protect us from the wiles of Satan, is familiar to all of us. I'm going to read verses 10 through 12 of the 6th chapter just to refresh our memories and then make a few comments on that. "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, because we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Therefore, take unto you the whole armor of God." We go to elaborate means to protect ourselves. We have locks on our cars. We have locks on our homes. We have some have security systems in their homes. We have computer passwords. And then we put all our passwords in a file and we have a password for our passwords. All to secure ourselves. That's not necessarily bad. But what about securing ourselves against the real criminal and the greatest danger? In the 4th, 5th, and previous to the 6th chapter of Ephesians, Paul talks about walking worthy of the vocation, walking in humility, patterning ourselves after the new man, walking in love, not in lust, walking in light, not in darkness, walking in wisdom, not in foolishness. In chapter 5, verse 19 of Ephesians, he says, "Be filled with the Spirit, not drunk with wine. Sing hymns, spiritual songs. Submitting yourselves one to another, not proud. Wives, submitting yourselves to your husbands. Husbands, loving your wives. Children, obeying your parents," chapter 6. Employee-employer, slave-master relationships. If we take those words to heart, and if we live by them, we will be in conflict with Satan. Because those are not the guidelines that Satan has given us. They are not what he wants us to do. So Paul ends the wonderful book of Ephesians by bringing us back to the equipment and the tools for victory. Paul shows us the cause of our greatest problems, and Paul wants to properly equip us. He wants us to dress for success. There was a book out several decades ago, and I'm dating myself a little bit, Dress for Success, and it told you what kind of colors to wear if you wanted to be successful in the corporate world. I think it was a rather frivolous book, but I remember a lot of people buying new suits based upon that. But in verse 12 of Ephesians, he talks to us of chapter 6, verse 12, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. And that's really the point I want to emphasize. Satan is not flesh and blood. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are not fighting people. We are fighting Satan. Now, Satan may use people as agents that we have to deal with, as maybe Job had to deal with his wife. But I believe they are only the means by which Satan and his demons are trying to get at and attack us. The worst situation you are or will face is not your problem. Our problem is Satan and the lusts that dwell within us. I think, therefore, many times we have been fighting the wrong battle and the wrong people. And we as a nation have been trying to legislate morality. And I have never seen that work. I'm older than most of you, younger than a few of you, but it doesn't matter. Did prohibition stop drunkenness? I can probably make a case that it increased it, because when you tell people they can't do it, that becomes what they, for some convoluted reason, don't. They want to do it the more. My mom, when I was a little boy, would sometimes say, you can't go to the neighbor's yard. I'd done something wrong. And I would mind her, but I would get as close to the property line as I could and lean over and hope I didn't lean my back. Why? Because I was rebellious. If we passed a law today outlawing homosexuality, would that cure the bane of homosexuality? No. If Roe versus Wade was reversed, would abortion cease? No. Maybe they'd be a little more clandestine, but I'm not even sure of that. Because we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. Therefore, human tools don't solve spiritual problems. Godly tools solve spiritual problems. Paul, writing in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18, says, we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. We are fighting an invisible enemy. And I just wanted to at least begin with that concept so that we don't forget it as we go through these 2 weeks. I've not met this young lady. I think she's probably in her late 20s, and I'm just going by appearances there. Her name is Elaine, and I'm going to pronounce it Huguenin, but it really doesn't matter. You pronounce it how you want. She lives in New Mexico. She has a photography business. It appears to me probably a one-person entrepreneurial photography business. I'm going to read to you from a Associated Press clipping that came out April 7th, 2014, so it's relatively recent. The Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, rejected an appeal Monday from a studio that refused to photograph a lesbian couple's commitment ceremony, letting stand a New Mexico, Supreme Court ruling that helped spur a national debate over gay rights and religious freedom. The justices left in place a unanimous state Supreme Court ruling that said Elaine Photography violated New Mexico's Human Rights Act by refusing to photograph a same-sex ceremony in the same way as if she had refused to photograph a wedding between people of different races. Elaine Photography owner Elaine Huguenin said taking the photos of Vanessa Wilcock and her partner would violate her religious beliefs, and she said she also had a right of artistic expression under the First Amendment that allowed her to choose what pictures to take and refrain from taking. She was, however, ordered to pay over $7,000 in attorney's fees in this case. Arizona, the neighboring state, earlier passed such a law, but Republican Governor Jan Brewer vetoed it under pressure and blistering criticism from major corporations and political leaders of both parties. Similar religious protection legislation has also been introduced around the country. 8 states, Alabama, Arizona, Kansas, Michigan, Montana, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Virginia, had asked the High Court to hear the case so lawmakers could have guidance in considering such measures. A national group defended this photography, and a national group also took the case of the complainants. But as far as I know, it continues to stand. Question. Could that impact you and I? And what would we do? I want you to answer, but not out loud. I just want you to ponder it. Again, I don't consider myself an alarmist and an extremist, but these things are beginning to come right down into our laps. Look at a couple of other things, just to kind of get our minds thinking today as we introduce this. About a month ago, the Hobby Lobby case was settled. It actually came down during the Eminence campout, because I remember walking across the campground and somebody had Googled it somehow, and they were very excited to tell me that Hobby Lobby had won. And this was a case, and many of you know, against the some of the provisions of what we call Obamacare, and it's a privately held, I don't want to call it a Christian organization, and maybe a God-fearing organization would be appropriate, that said they couldn't provide contraceptives under this to their conscience. And in this case, I want to be fair, the Supreme Court did come down, it seems, somewhat in favor of Hobby Lobby, and they no longer have to do that. Now, as I understand it, that ruling is quite limited because it only applies to private corporations, which by definition are going to be some of the smaller corporations. I was talking to a Christian lawyer, and I'll say Christian, a member of the Churches of Christ in our fellowship, and he was really surprised that they ruled this way because he thought the law as written did not apply. But it did. The city of Greece, not the country, this is a town in New York City, had recently in 2013, had a case in which they were being, they were suing against Galloway about the having a prayer to open their city council. And I can give you positive feedback on this. About a month ago, the ruling came down and they were again allowed to have prayer to open their city council meeting. But that will not be the only, nor will it be the last battle. City of Gilbert. Attorneys asked the full U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit to weigh in on a church lawsuit over Phoenix suburbs' flawed sign ordinance. I'm not going to read, I could, but I won't read this. I'll just give you my cliff notes of what this was about. There was an ordinance that had been passed that limited the size of signs that churches could use. And so your sign couldn't be very big and it couldn't be up very long. The problem and the reason the lawsuit came along is these same regulations did not apply to any other signs. Political signs, commercial signs of any size could be up for any duration. And it became a lawsuit, and to my knowledge, it's not one that's fully settled yet. And the city of Phoenix has a statute that applies the law differently to religious organizations than it does to others. Elaine's Flowers and Gifts. This is very similar to the photography case. This took place in Seattle, Washington. A mature lady owned this flower shop. One of her frequent customers came in, wanted to order flowers for his wedding, and it was a homosexual wedding. Her conscience would not allow her to provide flowers for that, so she declined. A lawsuit ensued, and she lost. Her name was Barnell Stutzman, owner of Arlene's Flowers and Gifts. She was sued, and she lost. I don't know how many small business owners we have here, but I know we have some. And this may be something you have to deal with. What would Toad Valley do? And I'm just thinking out loud. They have wedding receptions. I don't know if this has ever come up or not, but it's certainly quite plausible. I just pulled this off. This was the July 14th this year. Church of England votes to allow female bishops. Some of you may have seen this. I think I got this from USA Today, but I'm sure it just came off the wires. The leadership, one Justin Welby said, "Well done. It's about time that we have secured these rights for women." I don't consider that to be a sexist issue. I consider that to be a biblical issue. Closer to home, and we don't really like to, and I'm not trying to bash, I'm just trying to remind you of what's going on. America's largest Presbyterian body voted yesterday to change its definition of Christian marriage and permit individual churches to perform same-sex marriages. The new authoritative interpretation by the Presbyterian Church Book of Order gives individual pastors discretion to perform same-sex ceremonies where the practice is legal. In addition, the addition, which passed the General Assembly, stated, "Teaching elders may conduct a marriage service for any such couple in the place where their community gathers for worship," etc., etc. If you want to Google it and read more, fine. I have not been personally asked to perform a marriage of same-sex couples. Maybe somebody here has. I don't know. But I will be. And some of you will be. And what shall we do? And what is our legal position if we do? Well, I could just keep reading press releases and make us all shake our head and woe is us and what's the world coming to, but I'll stop with that because that's not really what my assignment is, although I think that is the gist. That is a basis for the assignment. I do not consider myself an optimist, nor do I consider myself a pessimist. I consider myself a realist. But so do you. But some of us are optimistic and some of us are pessimistic, even though we all call ourselves realists. A realist is simply someone that agrees with you. That's the best definition of a realist I've ever found. So I don't have a lot of people that I think are realists. Wayne Jackson, in an article entitled "Nation Out of Control," I thought made some interesting points, and I want to share just a few of them with you. In the perspective of our nation's future, and I'm trying to get all the depressing stuff kind of off of our palate so we can move on, I am not very optimistic. I am pessimistic about our nation. I think we have peaked. I'm not sure when we peaked. I'm just pretty sure we've already peaked. I think it will be a good place to live throughout my lifetime, and it may be a good time to live throughout my children's lifetime. Grandchildren and great-grandchildren, you're kind of on your own, because I just don't know. But what makes us think America is immune to the cycle that every other nation's gone through? That, to me, would be ignorant arrogance. And I'm capable of that. In Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34, it talks about how righteousness exalts a nation and wickedness doesn't. If righteousness exalts a nation, then it seems to me unrestrained sin will destroy it. And I believe we can make that case for every nation and every society, and I have to apply it to ours also. God gave Nineveh 40 days to get their act together. Jonah chapter 3, verse 4. They did. And he spared them for a century or so. They went right back to where they had been. And eventually, Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 9, Nineveh fell, complete and final. Just a few thoughts. One of the reasons I think our country is in free fall is we are in economic free fall. Our national debt is in excess of $17 trillion. Now that's got enough zeros and commas that I can't really relate to that. But I can break it down, or others have broken it down. The average person's share of our national debt is $56,000. That equates to $151,000 per taxpayer. And incidentally, less than half of Americans are taxpayers. If you had $1 trillion and you spent $3,000 a day, it would take you 1 million years to spend $1 trillion. So it's a lot of money. But more concerning to, I think, me and hopefully to us is the materialistic gravitational pull of our country that gets us into this mess. Why are we in this mess? And why are households in this mess? It's because we're materialistic. We want now rather than delayed gratification. Psalms 37:21, the wicked borrows and pays not again. In Proverbs 22:7, it alludes to indebtedness as servitude. Most everybody here probably has some debt, and I'm not against that. Most of us wouldn't have a house if we didn't incur some debt at some point. But Jesus talks to us in Matthew chapter 6 about what the true treasures are, doesn't he? I think our educational system, and we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, I think it's largely out of control. We have spent billions upon billions of dollars to produce not the most educated and learned children or people. And there are probably a multitude of reasons, but our concerns. I list three. An alarming number of our children are not getting educated. They're going to school, but that's different than being educated. In many cases, our educational system is a propagandizing tool for a humanistic agenda. And it's become one of somewhat environmental danger. Not so much here in the Midwest. It's caused many people to consider homeschooling for the first time. I have mixed views on that, but those are opinions. But I can understand the pull of that. Charles Skykes, in one of his books about this, says, has a chapter entitled, Why American Children Feel Good About Themselves But Can't Read, Write, or Add. That's a fascinating title. Because we elevate feeling good about ourselves more than being able to be productive. Well, it's nice to be both, isn't it? But not at the exclusion of all. Our judicial system, governmental. Harold Waxworth, who is a jurist or a judge in New York, wrote a book about this, and I just wanted to quote one of his comments. He wrote, and I quote, "We have formalized and technicalized, but we've used little common sense. It's about time that we wake up to the fact that we are in the fight of our lives. The bottom line is the criminals are going free, and there is no respect for truth, and without truth there could be no justice. Our system is carefully crafted maze constructed of elaborate and impenetrable barriers to the truth." I find that interesting because he is not a conservative. He is, or was, before he became a judge, a card-carrying member of the ACLU. And he comes to those conclusions. One other one. Morally. I just listed a couple of passages. In Titus chapter 2, verse 5, it talks about how the women are to be keepers of the home, discreet, caring for their family. I do not think it is wrong for a woman to work outside of the home. I do think it is wrong when in a family we neglect our families in order to work outside of the home, and we do it because of things we want rather than because of things that we need. Leaving children at daycare centers, not because the parents are forced to work in order to survive, but simply because they want more things of a material value. That's a high price to pay for what might be termed as parental irresponsibility. And we could go on and on about these things. And again, during these 2 weeks, we're going to have to go back and touch on some of them because that is our topic. But do nations turn around? Thank you. Seldom. But people can. And that's what we're about. People can. We live in a wonderful time, but we learn to live in a trepidatious time. I suspect we live in a materially wonderful time, but not a spiritually wonderful time. So Satan's strategy, remember I said I'd like to back off now because we could talk about all these red meat issues for a long time, and if I opened it up 10 minutes into my presentation, you could give me red meat commentary for the rest of the study and I'd fold up my notes and be happy. I believe Satan's strategy, if I could put it in one phrase, is to set our world view. Once you set a people's or a person's worldview, all of these other issues fall right into line based upon what that worldview is. Satan does not have to convince people that abortion is okay. He does not have to convince people that homosexuality is okay. He doesn't have to convince people that premarital sex is okay. He simply has to instill in them a worldview that makes all of those things okay. And then they have a life, I believe, of their own. So, what is our worldview? Well, first of all, what is a worldview? Alvin Toffler said, every person carries in his head a mental model of the world. And I think that's true. You all have a mental model of the world. You also have a mental model of heaven. We're not quite sure what it's going to be like, but everyone here has a mental model of heaven. If I say the word God, you've all got a mental model of what he looks like. Now, we all know we don't know, but we still have that mental image. This is a rather lengthy, in fact, it's going to be carried over to the next slide, but it's probably one of the most thorough and best definitions of a worldview that I found, so I share it with you. A worldview is a framework or a set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. This vision need not be fully articulated. It may not be explicitly developed into a systematic conception of life. It may not even be theoretically deepened into a philosophy. It may not even be codified into a creedal form. It may be greatly refined through cultural and historical development. Nevertheless, this system is a channel for the ultimate beliefs which give direction and meaning to life. It is the integrative and interpretive framework by which order and disorder are judged. It is the standard by which reality is managed and pursued. It is a set of hinges, listen to this, it is a set of hinges on which all of our everyday thinking and doing turns. That's a worldview. Now I'll back up. Some of you might have been trying to write that, but you can probably get it on the... Oh, yeah, and I want to give credit. That was not me talking. That was just me reading. James Olathius was the one that came up with that. But what he's saying is a worldview is the set of beliefs and values that each one of us has. They differ between us, maybe, but they're the beliefs and the values with which we determine our opinions and life decisions on everything else. So my point is, Satan simply has to instill in us a false worldview, and all of these other issues fall right into his lap. Of course, the opposite is also true. If God, and we allow God to instill into us an appropriate worldview, all of those issues will also be viewed that way. Or, shall we say, more appropriately. So, what is our worldview? What is your worldview? What is my worldview? What kind of worldview do we want to instill? Well, I think we would all answer, we want to instill the biblical worldview. But the reason our nation and other nations and nations cyclically have fallen and become decadent is that there has been a distorted worldview. Remember back in the book of Judges, probably the most decadent book in the Bible in terms of just gross sin and bloodshed. You know, they were cutting people up and sending parts of them all over the country. There's several times in the book of Judges it says, and everybody did what was right in their own sight. That was their worldview. If they thought it was right, it was right. Well, sounds a little familiar. Abortion, homosexuality, fornication, idolatry, greed, and murder, those are the battles. But it's the worldview that is the war. And our nation has lost its worldview. And we don't want the church to lose its worldview, although many religious organizations, I think I can make a strong case, have. It is our minds that are the battleground. Tozer wrote several articles on whether our minds are a playground or a battleground, and I thought that was he does a nice job with that. It's the minds of our children. It's the minds of our young people. When we see congregations not growing, when we see congregations dying, there are multiple reasons for that, but many, almost always in the core of that is we've lost the minds of the young people. Or maybe sometimes the older people. A world's view is what shapes our thoughts on life. And I've listed four things there, and they're not unique to me. I just assimilate what I can absorb and read. It shapes our thoughts on life's origin, on its meaning, on its mortality, and on its destiny. And if you shape people's thinking on those four things, you got them. And I believe that's exactly what Satan does. He shapes people's thoughts on those four things, and he's got them. Origin. How did I come to be? You know why Darwinism is so readily accepted? Because it gives an answer to origin that excludes God. And that's what people want. That's what people want. Meaning. What is it that binds us together and our existence and gives us meaning? Morality. How do I determine between what is right or wrong? Destiny. What happens to me when I die? When you get people to think your way on those four issues, you got them. Whether they think right or whether they think wrong, I believe you have them. And I believe Jesus and the Bible gives us answers to those questions. Naturalists say that we are simply dancing to our DNA. Jesus says we are sinners engaged in evil. 1 John chapter 2, verse 16. But Christianity demands that we come face to face with our moral condition. And Jesus gives us that solution. Okay, we've got about 6 minutes. I'm going to go just one more slide, and then I will give you a chance to make a comment if you want. But don't feel obligated to, because I already see that material won't be the issue. But I know it's just hard to sit there forever and contain yourself. So I want to encourage you, if you've got comments or questions, give them to me directly or give them Mark in that little box out there. And I will deal with them because these are all issues that we feel very, very strongly about. This slide has some quotes by a gentleman by the name of George Barna, who does quite a bit of survey taking and seems to be rather credible, but this isn't a survey. But he says, the primary reason that people do not act like Jesus is because they do not think like Jesus, and behavior stems from what we think. Our attitude, our beliefs, our values, and opinions. Kind of like what Jesus, whatever a man thinketh in his heart. Therefore, it affects our response to everything, from money to mortality, from politics to art. How or if we worship, our relationships, our study habits. Sadly, few people consistently demonstrate the love and obedience and the priorities of Jesus. Amen. But why? Because they have accepted a deviant worldview. Now tomorrow, we're going to look at those various worldviews. The theistic worldview, the pantheistic worldview, the naturalist worldview, the humanistic worldview, the atheistic worldview. And we're going to go through some of those, maybe to convince some of us, but also to give us a refresher in our minds of how to talk to people. Because I don't think you're going to convert people to the Lord Jesus Christ if we're not able to change their worldview. because it makes absolutely no sense. Now, we got 4 minutes, and you don't get out early, no matter. So I'm just going to pause, and if somebody does have a comment or a question or an addition to this that would be helpful before we move into it, you can kind of look at the outline that I left you that would be appropriate.